Case number 20-1247, Union of Concerned Scientists Petitioner versus United States Department of Energy. Mr. Bender for the petitioner, Ms. Carroll for the respondent.
Good morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is David Bender. I represent the petitioner, Union of Concerned Scientists in this case. UCS asked the court to vacate the Department of Energy's March 2020 final rulemaking order that established criteria and procedures for how the DOE will handle and share category of information called Critical Electric Infrastructure Information, or CEII. There are two problems with DOE's rules. First, primarily, DOE had no statutory authority to promulgate CEII criteria or procedures. Congress explicitly gave exclusive authority to do so to FERC and not to DOE.
Is your view then that FERC violated the law by specifically determining not to impose criteria or procedures on DOE?
That's not the basis for the argument of UCS. The problem ultimately was when DOE set its own procedures, it went forth and set its own procedures rather than, for example, incorporating FERC's substantive criteria and substantive procedures.
But wasn't FERC the boss of this matter? And did FERC decide necessarily it wasn't necessary to impose regulations upon DOE? And the statute said they had authority to do so if they thought it was necessary.
The statute, I believe, Your Honor, says that FERC will do so. And FERC adopted procedures and adopted criteria. As I read FERC's order, declining a comment by I believe the utility industry representatives to set additional procedures applicable to DOE, it declined to do so, leaving it open for DOE to follow FERC's procedures either on its own on a case-by-case basis, or, as I said, to adopt a rule incorporating FERC's substantive criteria, substantive procedures, for purposes of designations by the DOE.
I'm not sure you answered my question, counsel, but I understand your point.
Thank you. The UCS also.
Can I ask you about Article 3 standing before you get to the merits? Sure, so you've alleged informational injury as a basis for standing. Supreme Court has said that being denied information can qualify as a concrete injury for Article 3 purposes if Congress makes the injury concrete by enacting a disclosure statute giving the public rights to information along the lines of FOIA or FACA or statutes like that. This is not a disclosure statute. This is the opposite. This is a confidentiality statute. It's all about protecting information. And you don't point us to anything in the statute which you say creates a right of access to information.
The right to access to information. Well, first of all, Your Honor, I think that UCS has two kind of categories of injury. One is informational injury, as Your Honor points out, and the other is kind of a burden of accessing the information that there are through its rules. DOE created kind of additional hurdles, burdens, both a higher standard that UCS needs to show to have access compared to FERC's rules. There's also kind of a more frequent, unlike FERC's rules, there's no annual kind of clean bill of health to access information. So that's imposing some kind of costs to the organization.
Yeah, I'm not sure you preserved that one. I'll follow up on that, but could you just talk about informational injury?
Sure, thanks, Your Honor. The statute here has kind of dual purpose, or at least balances two interests. One is protecting information, certainly. And the other is to allow sharing for that information.
Not quite. It's allow voluntary sharing. And the voluntariness is of the relative to the people who have the information. And there's another provision in the statute which says very clearly that nothing in the statute requires people to share information who don't want to share information.
So I'm not sure I follow. So what I'm looking at, Your Honor, is in section D2
right.
of the statute, it provides that commission, being FERC,
right.
Shall promulgate regulations necessary to.
And then we go down to D.
Correct. And we say down to D, which facilitate voluntary sharing with and between and by. One is the government. So that's the holder of the information once it's filed. And then sub six is where UCS falls.
Sure. Other entities. Sure, but you're trying to get information. I mean, you wouldn't be in court. The only time you come to court is if you want information that the government doesn't, or some other, whatever, the owner of the electric facility doesn't want to give you that information. By definition, you're not seeking voluntary sharing. You're seeking an involuntary disclosure order.
I believe what UCS is seeking is information that the FERC would voluntarily share under its rules, but that DOE would not voluntarily share under DOE's rules. And that's the category of information that by operation of FERC's rules.
We're in four. Go down a couple of subparagraphs to six. Six says nothing in this section shall require a person or entity in possession of CEII to share such information with any list of people or other person or entity. Any federal, state, political subdivision, tribal authority, or any other person or entity.
Correct. The ability to access information then comes from, I guess, the overlay of the Freedom of Information Act, which then allows UCS and others, the public, access to information held by the government. And then the question does the information fall within an exception, being in this case the CEII statute?
Yeah,
but is your point, counsel, that we have to assume the merits for purposes of standing? And then the question is, why do you have Article III standing, even assuming, arguendo, your view on the merits? You don't show any declination of information.
Again, Your Honor, two categories, right? One, and I think we were going to come back to, is the kind of the increased administrative burden of seeking.
We'll get to that secondly. And there's an interesting question whether it's appropriate even to raise that in a reply brief. We have a couple of opinions on that. But let's talk about the first issue. Well, you've shown no concrete injury in the case, have you?
So we're showing
in terms of declination of information, even assuming you have a right to the information.
I think that's right, Your Honor, and that's why it was pled as an increased risk. I mean, it was we're anticipating application.
How does that meet standing? Don't you have to show something concrete?
According to the court's Atias decision, a risk, which then interprets the Supreme Court's Clapper decision, a risk of future harm is sufficient to show a concrete injury, and which is what we're looking at in this case. The UCS regularly seeks the type of information that is covered by, or at least the rulemaking order suggests will be covered by a CEII designation by the Department of Energy, in which case UCS will either have to show an affirmative national security interest in disclosing it to UCS or
this
be
is all, this is all very speculative, isn't it? I don't see how that establishes Article III injury. And even assuming you could do that, how do you meet the ripeness challenge?
So, I guess responding to those, both of those, Your Honor, a future injury is always, you know, in some sense, you know, speculative. But it's nevertheless an injury if there is a, you know, a substantial likelihood that it will impact UCS. And so in this case, UCS says through its declarations, as well as its rehearing petition, these are categories of information that UCS regularly and anticipates seeking in the future, and based on its interpretation, will be denied access to under DOE's rules. That's a future harm, but it's sufficient to show kind of an imminent injury to UCS. The ripeness question, Your Honor.
I just ask you, counsel, before you get to ripeness, even assuming the declarations are as they say, as you suggest, what about the discretion that's allowed in DOE's rule?
Your Honor, I believe the question is, would DOE, even if it had adopted FERC's rules, kind of substantive criteria and procedures, couldn't DOE nevertheless deny access kind of under some discretionary room within FERC's rules? And I believe we've addressed in the reply brief, which is, you know, even if there would be a similar harm under a different interpretation, you know, to meet the requirements for standing, we need to show an injury under the rules that that exist, I guess, under DOE's unlawful rule. That isn't diminished by the fact that there may be an injury, a future injury, similar future injury under a discretionary decision absent the illegal rule. And quickly addressing into my rebuttal, but quickly addressing Your Honor's question about redressability. In this case, the issue posed is the legality, whether or not DOE's rules meet the statutory delegation of authority and whether they are arbitrary or capricious. And that issue is ripe and can be redressed by an order vacating those rules. It doesn't require, and it's not premised on application of them to a particular denial.
But on that ripeness question, you have two criteria. The first is whether you have a pure legal issue as an Abbott laboratory, but the second is, have you been harmed? Are you harmed? And that seems quite speculative.
Briefly,
depends how DOE interprets a request.
But DOE has already announced in the preamble how it's going to interpret a request, at least to a particular set of information that UCS regularly seeks and obtains, which is the OE-417 forms. In the preamble to its final rulemaking, DOE has already announced it is going to exercise it will find.
It's what?
That the DOE, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
DOE announced in its preamble that it intends to designate OE-417 forms as CEII, which then means UCS no longer has access to those, which they regularly access, absent a high showing of national security interest, which is not required of them under FERC's rules. That's an injury, a non-speculative injury that is—
Why? Until you have a denial of information that you would otherwise get, you don't have an injury. And it's not clear to me you would ever have it. They use the term, they didn't use national security. They use another term that really is synonymous, right?
I'm past my time.
Please answer the judge's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The FERC's rules have a negative determination, a gating criteria, which is it just cannot be a national security risk compared to DOE's rules, which is requires an affirmative showing of a affirmative national security interest in the disclosure. And there's a gulf between the two, right, where information sharing with UCS is neither a harm nor affirmatively, you know, in advancing the national security interest. And it's that category of information that DOE's rulemaking preamble says, at least as to one category of forms that UCS regularly gets, that it is going to deem them CEII, which is then requires UCS to meet a higher burden and do so each time as opposed to once per year under the FERC's rules. And those are injuries to UCS that are reasonably foreseeable. I mean, it's as DOE has announced, it's going to happen.
Can I ask another question on injury, which is this statute has a judicial review provision governing specific determinations of CEII. This is paragraph 11. And that seems to allow parties to go to district court and seek review of a decision. And it requires the district court to examine the documents in camera to make a decision. So why isn't that good enough to enable you to litigate case by case when there's a concrete dispute about specific information?
Your Honor, I'd see the two as two categorically different. This case involves the standards that will apply and the procedures that will apply in designating and the section 11.
But when you're in an enforcement action, you can always argue that the standards are unlawful.
It's unclear that we can do that, given the standards were created through a rulemaking order. That's section 825L says we need to challenge in a petition to this court within a certain period of time,
But paragraph 11 says notwithstanding 825L, you can bring the as applied challenge once certain information is designated.
And even if you were right, we've often held in when a regulation is challenged and isn't ripe, you've satisfied your obligation to come to the court to challenge the regulation, and we would hold it until you had a concrete injury that was ripe. You know, I think it's Eagle Pitcher which we first decided that. Isn't that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. There's a procedural difference here as well, which is some of the harm will have occurred to UCS before in the both the delay and the denial before it can be reviewed under section 11. And that delay in accessing information that it regularly relies on is an injury separate from the injury of being denied ultimately whether or not UCS has access to the information. So to follow DOE's rules will require a longer delay, and it will require additional showings in the effort to access the information before the decision that's reviewable under Section 11, which is the denial itself.
All right, why don't we hear from counsel for respondent, and we'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yes, counsel for respondent.
Yes, good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Sarah Carroll on behalf of the government. DOE and FERC's rules are very similar, far more similar than different, and for that reason, petitioner cannot establish Article III standing. Even putting aside the informational interest point that Judge Katsas raised, petitioner can't show a substantial risk or a certainly impending threat that it will be denied information it would have received under FERC's rule. And I think it's important and related to this to clear up a couple of things that my colleague said that aren't quite right, that make the rules sound more different than they are. So for example, Mr. Bender said that DOE announced that it intends to designate these OE-417 forms as CEII, but that's simply not true. DOE adopted the same substantive criteria for designating CEII that FERC adopted. If you look at the regulatory provisions, DOE expressly incorporated the provision establishing FERC's criteria. And DOE made clear in the preamble to the final rule and in its rehearing order that it will designate information by applying those criteria on a case-by-case basis.
So I understand, counsel, your argument that if you put the two rules side by side, there are a lot of similarities. But obviously, the department thought it was necessary to promulgate a separate rule. So it wasn't just doing the same thing as FERC. And counsel has pointed to a couple of things in its brief and this morning. And I think you have to address those, don't you?
Sure, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I agree that there are differences. The rules are not identical. For one thing, first on putting up, before I get to the more substantive differences Your Honor referred to, there are of course formalistic different changes that need to be made. FERC's rule refers to, for example, FERC CEII coordinator doing things, and that wouldn't make sense in the context of a DOE rule. But so for example, this national security provision that's in DOE's rule, this is another one of the things that I wanted to clear up, because I think this is another area in which petitioner is kind of seeing a difference between the rules that isn't really there. It's true that FERC's rule does not include that language, but FERC's rule says that in deciding to whether to share CEII, FERC's CEII coordinator is to balance the requester's need for the information against the sensitivity of the information.
Oh, yes, but the department's rule puts the burden on the requester. All right, so that's the difference here, isn't it?
Well, the important clarification that I want to make, Your Honor, is that contrary to petitioner's reading, the department's rule does not require a requester to make an affirmative showing that disclosure would help national security. The requester has to show that disclosure would not hurt national security. But as I think we mentioned this.
Yes, so the answer to my question is yes, the burden is on the requester to show that releasing the requested information would not harm national security, to prove a negative, basically.
I think that's right, Your Honor, but I think that is true of FERC's rule as well. I can't speak for FERC, of course, but I would be very surprised if FERC released CEII without having received what it viewed as adequate assurance that release of the information would not hurt national security.
Excuse me, counsel, just pointed out, you can't speak for FERC. That raises the question that we asked you to address.
Yes.
Is FERC a necessary party here?
Your Honor, we don't think that FERC is the proper respondent or a necessary party here. I would start with this court's decision in Hoopa Valley Tribe v. FERC, which held that Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 19 addressing joinder does not apply in this court, and instead the governing rule is Rule 15 of the Rules of Appellate Procedure.
Which is silent on the question.
Right. This court held in Hoopa Valley that the proper respondent under Rule 15 is the agency that issued the order. And here, as I think you noted—
But that's a distinguishable case, isn't it? Because here, the crucial decision was made based on the statute. FERC made the decision that it wasn't necessary to impose the same criteria or procedures on DOE. And that was a Chevron deference kind of question, wasn't it? Whether it was necessary or not.
I agree, Your Honor, that I think a lot of petitioners' complaint here really comes down to what FERC did in 2016 and FERC's decision that it was not necessary to bind DOE with criteria or procedures, but petitioner could have challenged FERC's rule at the time it was issued. Petitioner participated in the rulemaking, did not address this issue, did not file a rehearing petition, did not file a petition for review within 60 days as required by Section 825L.
Now you're suggesting that FERC, he should have challenged FERC, that FERC was a necessary party, even though our rules don't address it one way or another.
Well, I'm saying, Your Honor, that if petitioner was unhappy that FERC did not regulate DOE, petitioner had ample opportunity to challenge what FERC did, but petitioner made clear that they do not challenge FERC's decision. And I think Your Honor is right that given FERC's decision that it was not necessary to establish regulations binding DOE, DOE was well within its authority to use the discretion that FERC had expressly left it. For example, FERC's rehearing order on its rule makes very clear that FERC does not think that DOE is required to change its regulations or to is precluded from designating CEII in accordance with the statute. And DOE was well within its authority to issue its rule, sort of as a matter of good government, to tell members of the public how it intended to exercise the leeway that FERC had left with it.
But DOE did adopt, at least arguably, your position, the same criteria as FERC had adopted.
Yes, that's right.
As opposed to procedures.
That's right, Your Honor. The criteria are the same. The procedures are slightly different, not very different. And for that reason, as I was saying earlier, petitioner can't establish standing to even bring this statutory argument or any of its other claims because it can't show that these very small differences in the procedures will actually lead to the denial of information it would have received under FERC's procedure.
Well, if I can just go back to the point I'm trying to understand here, is I understand your view or the department's view is that these two ways of implementing the statute are really very similar. All right?
Yes.
But they're not identical. You acknowledge that.
I do acknowledge that.
And in responding, just before Judge Silberman came back to the necessary party issue, you said you'd be surprised if FERC would release documents that are requested without making a determination that this would not adversely affect national security. And that may well be so, but the question here is who has the burden? And you're not suggesting, as I read your brief, that the requesting party would have the burden in submitting a request to prove this negative.
FERC and DOE.
So that bars the request, in effect.
So a couple of responses, Your Honor. First, both FERC and DOE require that people requesting CEII submit a detailed written request explaining why they need the information, how they will protect it, how they will use it. And that requires the requester to establish, among other things, that it can take good care of the information. Another important point that I want to note at this juncture is that petitioner did not even mention this national security provision in its rehearing petition before DOE. And this court has made very clear that 825L, the statutory provision under which petitioner seeks judicial review, imposes an unusually strict exhaustion requirement. So having failed to raise this before the agency, petitioner can't press it before this court, but even if petitioner could, FERC and DOE both require put the onus on a requester to show that its access to this information won't cause harm.
So I think you make a nice point on the national security argument, but I wonder about the lack of annual designation and then that type of thing. I mean, these are going to be very, as I would understand it, fairly burdensome requirements if you're broaching anything that may come close to national security, whether the rule says anything about it or not. I mean, the whole rule is designed to provide protection. So to the extent there are differences, your point, as I understood it, is even if there are differences, for purposes of standing, there's no showing here that any request would be denied under the DOE rule,
right,
that wouldn't be denied under the FERC rule.
Yes.
And isn't that the major hurdle here for, well, I shouldn't ask you, but for the CSI petitioners?
Yes, I think that's one of probably the major hurdle. There are other major hurdles. I'm glad Your Honor mentioned the burden point, because I wanted to be sure to note that petitioner indeed did not make these burden arguments related to standing in the opening brief. Our brief therefore doesn't address it because it wasn't raised in a timely manner. But you know, even if they had raised it, the rules of DOE's rule does not impose a larger burden on a significantly larger burden on petitioner than FERC's rule would, and I could explain that if it would help the court. But it's also just not preserved. I want to be sure I address any other questions the court might have.
Can you just assume, it's a big assumption, but assume we get to the merits. How do you justify any differences in the designation standards? Statute seems clear as can be that FERC has an obligation to promulgate the criteria and processes for designation, and FERC and DOE may designate pursuant to those criteria and processes.
I want to be sure that I'm understanding Your Honor's question. Are you just asking how we read that language to give DOE authority to issue its own rule, or are you wondering about kind of
its own rules that are different from FERC's?
Right. Well, as I was discussing with Judge Silberman, FERC decided that it was not necessary to bind DOE and that it would be better not to do so in light of differences between their activities and their missions. And so FERC therefore left DOE with room to designate CEII through, you know, as it saw fit. And there are minor differences, as I was discussing with Judge Rogers, between the procedures, though not the criteria for designating CEII. But DOE explained that it adopted those differences primarily because DOE receives much of the CEII or claimed CEII in its possession through voluntary submissions. So as I understand it, DOE does a lot of cooperative work with outside entities to try to work together to protect the energy infrastructure. And that's something that Congress clearly cared a lot about in the FAST Act. For example, subsection E of the statute emphasizes that DOE is supposed to, that the agencies are supposed to work, you know, to communicate as much as possible with other entities as they can to cooperate on these things. And so DOE did make some small tweaks to its procedures to, I think, in the interest of kind of giving entities submitting very sensitive information a little comfort that a little, you know, perhaps more comfort that it wouldn't be disclosed without at least thoroughly airing the issues and making sure that disclosure wouldn't pose, you know, big problems. But that is well within the discretion that FERC left to DOE, which is consistent with the statute.
I mean, I understand that's your position, but the statute seems to require DOE to use FERC's criteria.
The way we read that language, I understand your point, Your Honor, but the way
your theory has to be that there's some general default grant of rulemaking authority within DOE that they can enlist to supplement the standards that govern CEII. And that just seems very strange when the CEII system is very specific, is self-contained in this statute, has a lot of detail, and contemplates coordination and some degree of hierarchy as between FERC sort of over and directing DOE.
I agree that the statute contemplates that FERC will be in some ways at least sort of in charge of the CEII enterprise. And I don't think we would contend that DOE could structure its CEII program in a way that FERC didn't want it to or had told it not to do, but we think that DOE is designating CEII pursuant to FERC's rule when essentially, you know, in its rulemaking, FERC said, we don't think we need to adopt things that would bind DOE and we're gonna leave DOE discretion. And DOE is acting pursuant to that decision.
But your point is, you argue that the criteria that DOE has adopted is the same. That's your position. The procedures are different.
Yes, and only slightly different.
Yes.
Right, but the statute at every critical turn talks about criteria and processes together as things that some things are done by FERC and DOE can designate under rules, criteria and per criteria and processes established by FERC.
That's true. But again, FERC in making its rule decided to leave DOE with latitude to make these discussions. And even if petitioner were right that DOE should instead be applying FERC's very slightly different procedures, there's certainly no good reason to think things would come out significantly differently, which I think is relevant to the merits, but also to the standing
Brings us back to standing. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, anything further, counsel?
Nothing unless the court has more questions.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
So we'll hear from counsel for petitioner. Give you another 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to address a couple of statements that are incorrect, at least based on my reading from my colleague. The statement that there's no affirmative showing required by DOE's rules in order for UCS to access CEII. That can't be squared with the rule that the agency wrote. Subsection J2 of DOE's rule specifically says a request by a non-federal entity, that's UCS, shall not be entertained unless requesting non-federal entity demonstrates that the release of information is in the national security interest. That's an affirmative showing, and the burden rests on UCS to make it each and every time it seeks to access CEII. That's categorically different.
And so what about the forfeiture argument?
Your Honor, this issue is the specifics of this rule is a question of access. Who can access and under what conditions? And that was specifically preserved in the rehearing petition at JA36. UCS says they have effectively no means to access CEII under DOE's rules, unlike FERC's. And it was—
So I guess the argument is, you may have made the broad statement, but you didn't alert the agency to the specifics that you're concerned about and arguing today before the court.
Your Honor, I believe if you look at the response at JA10, where DOE responds to this, they cite DOE's rule, J2, and they cite FERC's not really the same, but kind of analogous in 388.113G and compare the two. I mean, it was enough, and FERC's response shows that it was enough to alert it to this difference. And that's why it responded the way it did. See that I'm out of time. Thank you, Your Honor. And we asked that the-
I'd like to ask one last question. Why did you not forfeit the burden argument? You only raised it in the reply brief.
It's similar to my response to Judge Rogers, which is we raised the inability of UCS to access information once it's designated as CEII in the opening brief. And then as the standing argument was made, that we, I guess, put more detail to it. And the J2 subsection is more detailed, but it falls within the overall
problem. Isn't there a difference between denial to information and burden in gaining the information? They're two different concepts, aren't they?
They're related, Your Honor, in that if we can't meet the burden, we don't get the information. And that's the problem.
That's a clever response.
Nothing further. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement.